Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is May 31, 1982, and this is my audio letter number 75. Here in the United States, today is a major holiday, Memorial Day. For most of us, it's a day off from our jobs, a day for picnics or to visit friends and relatives. The Memorial Day weekend is famous for traffic jams, highway accidents, and the Indianapolis 500 auto race. And Memorial Day is a seasonal turning point, marking the beginning of the traditional summer vacation season. Most of us tend to welcome Memorial Day as the gateway to summer. But Memorial Day also has a more solemn meaning, which we sometimes forget. It's the day we have set aside to honor the servicemen who have died fighting for our country. Memorial Day is a reminder that war has become a stark reality for America, time after time, and each time the cost in human lives has been tragic. As I look ahead to the summer of 1982 now beginning, it's with mixed feelings. Like most other Americans, I'm looking forward to the activities that make the summer vacation season a time to enjoy. But the summer ahead will also be a time of increasing danger for America. The timetable for nuclear war, which I made public 3 months ago in Audio Letter 72, is still in effect, my friends. That timetable calls for Nuclear War I to erupt by mid-September 1982, barely 3 months from now. The American Bolsheviks, who now control the United States Pentagon, are not slowing down in their war preparations. This is true in spite of the fact that part of their war plan has been crippled, as I detailed last month. The covert warfare that spawned the so-called Falklands crisis has all but ruined the Pentagon plans for final victory in the coming war. But the Bolshevik war planners here have a suicidal streak in their thinking, and they are bent on war regardless of the consequences. As I say these words, headlines are growing larger and larger about the Falklands War between Argentina and Britain. Since I spoke to you last month, heavy losses have been reported on both sides. Argentina has lost her only cruiser, the General Belgrano, plus several minor vessels and a number of aircraft. Britain has so far admitted losing 5 major ships, 2 destroyers, 2 frigates, and a container ship full of war material. These reports reflect the scale of the present fighting somewhat, but they are incomplete and distorted. As in every war, the truth has become the first casualty. My 3 special topics for this audio letter are Topic number 1, the Pentagon countdown toward Nuclear War I. Topic number 2, the economic attack on the United States Constitution. And topic number 3, Billy Graham versus the Bolshevik War Lobby. Topic number 1. In Audio Letter 73 2 months ago, I revealed that an entire new nuclear war strategy against Russia is being developed here in Washington. It is being worked out by an elite military planning group in extreme secrecy under the codename Project Z. It's a rush project, calling for Nuclear War I itself to begin by September of this year, 1982. Last month, I reported that Project Z was continuing to move fast at the secret war planning room here in downtown Washington. As I stated, the process of fleshing out the basic war plan was already underway. Now, my friends, the first complete draft of the total Project Z war plan is ready. The plan is essentially completed, with nothing left to do but make minor refinements here and there. And now, the existence of this major new United States nuclear war plan is creeping into the news. Just yesterday, May 30, an article about it appeared for the very first time in the New York Times. The article by Richard Halloran carries the headline, Pentagon draws up first strategy for fighting a long nuclear war. The article begins, quote, Defense Department policymakers in a new 5-year defense plan have accepted the premise that nuclear conflict with the Soviet Union could be protracted, and have drawn up their first strategy for fighting such a war, unquote. The article goes on to mention that the plan is laid out in an unpublished document of 125 pages. It's been drafted for approval by Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger. My friends, I've reported many times now that the United States Pentagon is controlled by the Bolsheviks who formerly controlled Russia. I've also identified Weinberger as the highest visible agent of the Bolsheviks here in the United States government today. The nuclear war plans of the Bolsheviks here are moving fast, but as I have also reported before, the United States government today is a house divided. The Bolsheviks are opposed by their bitter rivals, the Rockefeller cartel. Their top visible operative in the federal government today is Secretary of State Alexander Haig. The often visible feuding between Haig and Weinberger is only a pale shadow of this deadly power struggle behind the scenes. Unlike the Bolsheviks here, the Rockefeller faction do not want nuclear war. In a word, they cannot afford it. They would lose everything. And so the Rockefeller faction here is working feverishly to head off the Bolshevik nuclear war plan. The new anti-Bolshevik rulers of Russia are also against nuclear war. The anti-Bolshevik, anti-nuclear war attitudes of the Rockefeller cartel and the Kremlin has led to a limited coalition between them in recent months. The most spectacular result so far from this Rockefeller-Russian coalition is the Falklands War, now raging between Argentina and Britain. In Audio Letter 74 last month, I reported what the Falklands War is all about. It is the visible aftermath to covert warfare which took place during April. The Rockefeller cartel and the Russians joined forces to destroy certain major military installations and weapons reserves. These were key ingredients in the final phase of the Project Z war plan. The whole operation began at South Georgia Island on April 3rd. With the help of Argentina, a joint Rockefeller-Russian commando team was able to knock out the giant hidden naval base there. The base, built during the 1960s, was originally controlled through the United States government by the Rockefeller cartel. But the Bolsheviks here acquired control of the bases about 3 years ago when they seized control of the American Pentagon. Last month I detailed how the attack on the base was carried out. It was contained within a giant man-made cavern, hollowed out inside a mountain near the water. With the camouflage ship entrances sealed up, the base was bomb-proof. But the joint Rockefeller-Russian commando team succeeded in attacking the base by drilling a shaft through the mountain. Then a compact Russian neutron bomb was inserted through the shaft and detonated inside the cavernous naval base. The process took several weeks. The Thatcher government, which, like the United States Pentagon, is Bolshevik-controlled, dispatched the Royal Navy. First, it was supposed to dislodge the heavily armed Rockefeller-Russian military force before it could destroy the naval base. Then it was to move on to the Falklands for the publicly admitted fighting. The Royal Navy arrived several days too late to save the secret base on South Georgia Island, as I reported last month. But by that time, the panicking Thatcher government had already committed some two-thirds of the Royal Navy to the South Atlantic. On top of that, at least one British ship had already been sunk by Russia in connection with the secret South Georgia operation. That left the Thatcher government with no choice but to engage Argentina in battle. Otherwise, it would have been impossible to explain away Britain's huge deployment to the South Atlantic, much less the heavy losses which had been sustained. When I recorded Audio Letter 74 last month on April 30, the British blockade of the Falklands was just beginning. Later that day, the entity President Reagan announced that the United States was actively siding with Britain. The announcement was a victory for the Pentagon war faction. Right away, warfare around the Falklands started heating up fast. On May 1, the British launched bombing raids against the airport at Port Stanley. And on May 2, a British submarine torpedoed Argentina's second-largest ship, the cruiser General Belgrano. It sank within 24 hours, leaving a death toll of more than 300 Argentine sailors. The sinking of the Belgrano was expected to demoralize the Argentines, but instead it enraged them. The Belgrano had been sunk at a time when it was not threatening the British forces. The Argentines decided it was time to start playing their ace in the hole against Britain. Last month I reported that Argentina had been given certain promises in return for making the secret South Georgia operation possible. One of these was the promise of covert military assistance by Russia against Britain. Specifically, it was pledged that the Russians would intervene in parallel with Argentine air and naval operations in ways designed to even the odds. In this way, Argentina's military leaders can take full credit for both their own and covert Russian attacks on the British. At the same time, this procedure is designed to keep Russia's role in the fighting obscure. On May 4, the Argentine Air Force decided to put Russia's promises to the test. A pair of fighter bombers headed out over the Atlantic to attack the Royal Navy. Acting on reconnaissance data provided by Russian spy satellites, they headed straight for the fleet. As the two low-flying Argentine jets appeared on the horizon, they were picked up by British fleet radar. At the same time, a Russian Cosmosphere hovering many miles above the fleet took final aim at one of the ships. The ship was one of Britain's newest, most modern, most sophisticated ships, designed specifically to shield the fleet against air attack. The ship was a Type 42 guided missile destroyer, HMS Sheffield. Long before the two Argentine jets were close enough to attack, the Cosmosphere fired its charged particle beam weapon downward at the ship. The white-hot beam of subatomic particles blasted through the aluminum superstructure just behind the bridge near the top of the ship. In a split second, the beam seared through layers of metal, downward into the bowels of the ship. The aluminum of the ship itself was instantly ablaze. The Argentine fighter pilots witnessed the spectacular explosion and intense white flames from nearly 20 miles away. They promptly turned back toward home, having expended no missiles. Bewildered survivors from the Sheffield later said there had been no warning before the blast. Argentina's leaders are being coached by Rockefeller cartel operatives in what to say publicly about war developments. They claim that a French-made missile called the Exocet had been used to sink the Sheffield. But to those who know the characteristics of the Exocet missile, the Sheffield disaster remained a mystery. The Exocet, my friends, is a type of missile known as a sea skimmer. It's designed to skim along just above the water, striking a ship almost at the waterline. File films of the Exocet, which have been shown on TV, clearly show this behavior. But the Sheffield was blasted close to the very top of the superstructure. In fact, that is said to be the reason for the relatively low casualty toll in the destruction of HMS Sheffield. Had the same blast been aimed low, close to the waterline, the ship probably would have heeled over and sunk fast. Had that happened, very few of the crew would have escaped. On the evening of May 4, Admiral Martin Weems, former director of the British Naval Warfare, was interviewed about the Sheffield disaster on ABC Nightline. Ted Koppel began with the words, "Admiral Weems, how is it that such a modern ship would not have been able to, first of all, detect and then destroy that Argentine aircraft?" Admiral Weems answered, quote, "I think that's an extremely good question, and I cannot give you a straight answer. In my book, this should not have happened," unquote. For the next 2 weeks, talks between Argentina and Britain continued, with United Nations Secretary General Perez de Cuellar attempting to mediate. Meanwhile, the Thatcher government continued to add to the British armada in the South Atlantic. Even the luxury liner Queen Elizabeth II was commandeered and turned into a troop ship. It sailed with some 3,200 troops aboard on May 12. The strategy of the Bolshevik-dominated Thatcher government is very simple, my friends. They know very well they are sending the Royal Navy into a trap. But they believe that by multiplying naval strength in the South Atlantic virtually beyond reason, they will win. They are making the British commitment so huge compared to that of Argentina that a total Argentine rout of the British would look unreasonable. It would enable the question of covert Russian aid to Argentina to be raised openly and credibly, and that could help to set off the very nuclear war which they know Russia is trying to avoid. Following this brute force strategy, the Thatcher government has continued to pour every available ship into the South Atlantic fray. As of now, over 100 British ships are either in the war zone or heading toward it. That's almost the entire Royal Navy. The attitude is, for every ship the Russians and Argentinians sink, the Thatcher government will just send two more. Anything to make sure Britain retakes the Falklands. Because if that is not accomplished, the Thatcher government will fall. And that will be a setback to Bolshevik power in Britain. On May 19, the last-ditch talks at the United Nations finally collapsed. Britain was ready at last to invade. After talks ended that evening, it was announced that the British War Cabinet would meet the following morning. Supposedly, the meeting would decide whether to give the go-ahead for invasion. But it was all a ruse to help create an element of surprise against Argentina and against Russia. The first stage of an elaborate invasion strategy was already going into action. On the evening of May 19, the British invasion fleet was divided up into two groups. One group was 150 miles due east of Port Stanley, the other 100 miles to the northeast. Shortly before midnight Washington time, both invasion forces started heading toward shore. Russian Cosmospheres and submarines went into action, working together. Both British assault groups came under fire. At least two ships critical to an assault were hit and heavily damaged. By 2 a.m. Washington time, both assault forces aborted their moves toward the Port Stanley area. In response, Russian forces disengaged. The Russians believed they had thwarted the British invasion. But, my friends, they were wrong. The two large invasion groups threatening Port Stanley the night of May 19 were actually carrying out a diversionary action. British strategists knew that the Russians had the muscle available to stop any invasion. The only chance of success lay in convincing the Russians that they had stopped the invasion and then somehow sneaking troops ashore. So the two large invasion forces of May 19 actually were staging a decoy action. Most of the British invasion troops were no longer aboard the troop carrier Canberra or the assault ships. Instead, they had been transferred to other ships, which normally are not used for amphibious purposes. On the morning of May 20, the elaborate British deception continued. Up until the previous day, British statements had been referring to an imminent all-out invasion. But on the morning of May 20, the statements changed abruptly. British Defense Ministry spokesmen suddenly started saying that the British would confine themselves to small hit-and-run raids for a while. The Bolshevik military planners in London wanted to further convince Russia that the invasion had been stopped the previous night. It worked. Small groups of British ships began moving around the Falklands, as if to plant small raiding parties here and there. In early morning darkness of May 21, one of these small groups of ships moved into the north end of Falkland Sound, between the islands. Contrary to press reports, the troop ship Canberra was not among them, nor was an assault ship. Those ships would have tipped off the Russians, monitoring everything from cosmospheres far above, that a major landing was afoot. Instead, the key ship that moved into San Carlos Bay was the hospital ship Uganda. Under cover of darkness, the Uganda moved close to shore. British assault troops, crammed like sardines into the Uganda, clambered down the sides of the ship on rope ladders into motor launches. The launches ferried the troops a short distance ashore, one group after another. As soon as they were ashore, the troops had orders to spread out fast. In that way, they rendered themselves unsuitable targets for any attack by the Russian cosmospheres patrolling miles above. Particle beam weapons are devastating against concentrated targets, but very inefficient against personnel scattered over a wide area. By dawn, other ships had also disembarked troops in the same manner. By the time daylight revealed what was really going on, it was too late. The British invasion of the Falklands was underway. Once the British got ashore with a sizable number of troops, Britain's chances of regaining control of the island started increasing fast. Covert Russian help for the Argentines is much more feasible at sea and in the air than on land. In the past 10 days, we've heard about a number of devastating air attacks by the Argentines. Up to now, the British have admitted losing at least 5 ships, plus several helicopters and Harrier jump jets. But slowly, the British ground forces have been reinforced and started advancing across East Falkland Island towards Port Stanley. As of today, May 31, British ground forces are said to be closing in on the main Argentine garrison at Port Stanley. The operation is being portrayed in the news here as a relatively easy task, but that is far from true. British casualties in the land battle have been far greater than admitted, and at sea, the Royal Navy has taken very heavy losses that are not even hinted at so far in the news. Many ships have been badly damaged, and all, I repeat, all of the original contingent of the Sea Harrier jump jets have been put out of action. Both British aircraft carriers, the Hermes and the Invincible, have been rendered incapable of launching jets. The Harriers now operating around the Falklands are a different type from the sharp-nosed, blue-painted Sea Harriers. They are painted in green and brown camouflage. My friends, they are United States Marine Corps Harriers, and they are operating from an American ship. The things I am revealing here, my friends, are at variance with official stories. But this is the war you never see. Photos of British amphibious exercises taken at Ascension Island were passed off as pictures of the Falklands invasion. British Broadcasting Corporation broadcasting facilities on Ascension Island were taken over weeks ago by British military. Now we hear daily reports from Ascension Island that are claimed to be originating with the task force. Even more than usual, the truth has been the first casualty in the Falklands War. The Bolshevik military planners here and in the Thatcher government in Britain are trying to find some way to use the Falklands War for their own purposes. Up to now, they still are not slowing down in their fast timetable for Nuclear War I. Within a few short weeks, there will be a highly visible clue to the status of the Bolshevik Nuclear War schedule. I'm referring, my friends, to the upcoming 4th Space Shuttle flight. All the Space Shuttle flights up to now have been military in nature, as I've detailed in the past. The Space Shuttle is the Pentagon's only hope to regain a military toehold in space for the coming war. Now, for the first time, it is even being admitted that the next shuttle flight will be military. Shuttle Flight Number 4 is presently scheduled for June 27, less than a month from now. If some excuse is found to delay the flight, it will reflect a slowdown in the nuclear war plans of the Pentagon. But if Shuttle Number 4 takes off on schedule, it will indicate that the Bolsheviks here are still sticking to their September war deadline. In Audio Letter 73, I reported that for the first time, the shuttle had been successful in its prime military mission. A hardened, laser-armed super-spy satellite was orbited in March to obtain fresh reconnaissance data on Russia. It's the first updating of Russian target data since Russia destroyed American spy satellites some 4 years ago. Target data from the new satellite is now being integrated into the Project Z nuclear war plan, which I made public in Audio Letter 73. Now, Space Shuttle Number 4 is being prepared for a different mission. Under the Project Z war plan, The coming nuclear war will begin with a surprise nuclear attack by American stealth planes into Russia. They will attempt to knock out all of Russia's space bases, 4 cosmodromes for rockets, plus cosmosphere installations in Siberia. If all goes as planned, all these installations will be blown up with H-bombs simultaneously. As soon as that happens, the rest of America's nuclear arsenal is to be launched at Russia, as I have described before. But there remains one weak point in the Bolshevik first strike plan against Russia. As it stands now, the Bolsheviks here will have to assume that the first phase of the attack plan has succeeded, as of a given time. The reason is that the United States currently has no means of verifying if the initial stealth attack has succeeded. When Russia destroyed America's spy satellites 4 years ago, she also destroyed our high-flying early warning satellites. That leaves the Bolshevik war planners here without any way to tell if their bombs have exploded in Russia. Space Shuttle No. 4 is intended to solve that problem within weeks from now. The super-secret Department of Defense payload is a cryogenic infrared sensor system. It's designed to look down at Russia from geostationary orbit. It will detect the explosions of American H-bombs in Russia when it happens. The moment that it flashes a signal confirming the explosions to the Pentagon, the rest of the American nuclear first strike against Russia will be set in motion. In order to do its job, the Air Force infrared sensor has to be placed in geostationary orbit. That orbit is over 22,000 miles high, over the equator. The shuttle itself cannot go that high. It can only go to low Earth orbit, perhaps 150 miles up. To take the Air Force sensor system the rest of the way, it has to be mounted on a rocket. The shuttle will carry the whole assembly, sensor system, rocket and all, into low Earth orbit. From there, the rocket will take the sensor system out to the desired location far above the equator. My friends, as of now, the countdown toward nuclear war I is still being continued by the Bolshevik war planners in the Pentagon. The Falklands crisis began as an effort to prevent or delay nuclear war, but it may instead end up helping to set off that very war. If so, America's fourth space shuttle flight could turn out to be America's final manned mission into space. The Air Force sensor to verify success of America's coming initial attack on Russia will eventually be destroyed by Russian space weapons. Before that can happen, the Bolshevik planners in the Pentagon will try to set off nuclear war I.